here.
This is
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen coming to you for a special edition of Taking Aim. Greetings to all of you in the tri-state region of New York and those of you listening on the internet at www.wbai.org, be it in the Bay Area of San Francisco, where we are, in Washington State, in Oregon, in Upper New York State, in New England, in Italy, and in many countries throughout the world.
China, Iran, Cuba, Sweden. We are listened to on an extraordinarily wide basis, thanks to the Internet.
And thanks to WBAI. For those of you who aren't aware of Taking Aim, we're normally on Tuesday from 5 to 6 p.m. And today we are here again with a very special program, The Underlying Politics of 9/11. That's our premium for our contribution to the WBAI Fund Drive. Our thank you to you for your contribution of $100. As you know, WBAI is a very special place on the radio dial. Without it, you wouldn't be hearing Ralph Schoenman and myself, and the meticulous documentation and synthesis of data that we have been providing for almost 2 years. Ralph Schoenman, you may have first heard soon after the events of 9/11 with the World Trade Center Uncensored History, an unprecedented WBAI fund drive event. Since then, with Taking Aim, we have been analyzing the reasons for 9/11, what is behind it, why a sector of the ruling class staged it. Yes, staged it. And what have been the consequences? And also we've looked at the background to the assault against Afghanistan, the assault against the Iraqi people, and as former CIA Director James Woolsey said, World War IV. Ralph?
Well, in fact, what we've done over this period of time and why we place this in a particular context is to examine the structure of power in this society, because the events that unfold and surround us cannot be understood properly without seeing clearly how power is organized, who rules, and in whose interests in this country. We so often cite the data pertaining to that, for example, in the New York Times, documenting that 1% of the population today owns and controls 90% of the national wealth in the United States. They average 14 corporate directorships per person. This, by any criterion, is a ruling class. It is a tiny, concentrated cabal commanding the state apparatus and deploying it to pursue their specific economic and monetary interests.
Now that's a taste of the type of programming that we bring to you on Taking Aim on WBAI. It's the only station on which you're going to hear this in the tri-state New York region. That's 212-209-2950. And we have The Underlying Politics of 9/11, 212-209-2950. We're coming to you today by telephone from California. Normally, we're in a studio, and you get impeccable sound. And we want to thank Sean Rhodes, our engineer today at the WBAI studio, for assisting us. Now, we can't see the phone lines, but later we're going to hear those jingle, jingle, jingle as the phone goes on with when you start calling in. And I want to remind you again, 212-209-2950. This is our radio station, and it can only go on with your participation. And that's why we prepared this very special gift, The Underlying Politics of 9/11. It's 2 hours and 40 minutes, compact on two CDs with incredible audio editing by Yara Mako of Guns and Butter on KPFA. So that's 212-209-2950. The more you call, the more you're going to get to hear of the underlying politics of 9/11.
In this particular presentation, we document who and what and why with respect to 9/11. We demonstrate the hands of U.S. intelligence over every aspect of this event. We show its antecedents in the perpetual quest of pretext for long-standing plans of U.S. imperialism, from blowing up the Maine in the Havana Harbor for the pretext of seizing the colonies of Spain, Cuba, and the Philippines, to the sinking of the Lusitania through the deliberate providing of the coordinates of that passenger ship to German submarines as a pretext for entering World War One, and on and on and on.
Okay, Ralph, instead of going on and on, let's get to the underlying politics of 9/11. 212-209-2950. And get to your phone while it's playing, because, after all, you're going to call in, you're going to give your pledge, and as a result of that, you're going to have the full 2-CD 2 hours and 40 minutes, The Underlying Politics of 9/11. This is a program you have not heard. If you've heard our other programming on 9/11, this is still something new. It's something you're going to want to have in your library, you're going to want to share with all your friends, your families, and your colleagues. In other words, you're not going to want to be without it. 212-209-2950. We're going to be with you in a momentarily. We're going to play now part of the presentation by Ralph of The Underlying Politics of 9/11. Sean?
I'm grateful to you for coming out on a Sunday afternoon. I want to express my particular appreciation, Maya's and mine, to the Solano Peace and Justice Coalition for sponsoring and arranging this event, to the Community Labor Alliance, and, of course, in particular, to Doug McDonald, who is the point man, the energizer, the real organizer of this event. And, of course, I want to express here my warm thanks and appreciation to Bonnie Faulkner and to Yaramako and to Guns and Butter for their continued important broadcasting and researching and organizing and activating the struggle regarding not only 9/11 but the nature of power in this society. I should tell you that Guns and Butter and Taking Aim, Bonnie and ourselves, are involved in something called the Center for Interdependent Communication, which is going to hopefully to extend the reach of this information and the broadcasting that we do, and we urge your support and your involvement in those efforts. What we'll be dealing with tonight, this afternoon I should say, is a structure of power. And in relation to that structure of power, the standard means of operating a state in the hands of a tiny cabal. Because the evidence is overwhelming and documented from all and official sources as to the nature and character of the state in our society. The Department of Commerce in the United States had acknowledged that 2% of our population owns and controls 90% of the national wealth. By now, that figure has doubled. The New York Times has avowed that it is, in fact, no more than 1% that has command over 90% of the national wealth in our society. The former president of Avis and American Express, Robert Townsend, in his book Up the Organization, calculated that the actual number of people who control what he called the commanding heights of our economy number approximately 5,000. This is a very extraordinarily concentrated power in the hands of a ruling class. And the state is their vehicle. The state is their subsidized funding instrument on the backs of working people and taxpayers in the United States. As you're well aware, the largest corporations, the 10 largest corporations, pay no taxes for 10 years at a time. It is but the milk cow for subsidizing the control and rule of a ruling class that funds and controls the political process, the one big property party with two names, through which they sustain their imperial rule. Every major spokesperson from the mid-19th century to the present day, from all nominal political parties of the established order, have articulated the need for an imperial reach on the part of American capitalism. This has been the common theme of William McKinley and Grover Cleveland, of Woodrow Wilson and Herbert Hoover, of Franklin Roosevelt, and of all the successor regimes that have succeeded him. Indeed, Virgil Jordan, the chairman of the National Industrial Board of Franklin Roosevelt, said very clearly that the United States had set its foot upon an imperial path from which it had no exit and to which it was compelled, namely the securing of resources and cheap labor in every corner of the planet and the provision of the military apparatus to make it feasible. It's within that structure of power that we have to see and understand that every major imperial adventure in the history of our country has proceeded on the basis of pretext. Replete with evidence from Remember the Maine, when the United States military blew up the Maine in the harbor of Havana, imputed this to the Spanish, and used that as the pretext, the casus belli, for seizing Cuba and the Philippines. From the sinking of the Lusitania, the rationale for the American entry into World War I, when American imperialism announced itself as prepared to challenge its rival European imperial powers for their colonial domain. To Pearl Harbor, an event precipitated by American fleet action in the Pacific, all the modalities of which in the hands of American intelligence for weeks and months preceding, the Soviet Union having cracked the Japanese code and supplied that information to the United States government. To the Korean War, as I have Stone so amply documented in the hidden history of the Korean War, when a series of covert operations on the part of the United States targeting key industrial and military installations in North Korea elicited the response that became the rationale for the UN-sponsored war. To the Gulf of Tonkin and the war in Indochina itself. On and on and on. The false flag operations that constitute the modus operandi of American imperialism. 9/11 is a false flag operation in line and in the tradition of all the others. It is all the characteristics, all the features, all the evidentiary basis, all of the hallmarks of intelligence-controlled operations imputed to demonize others, to provide a rationale for plans decades in preparation, the false category of terror. For in the advent of the demise of the Soviet Union, when the rationale for ever-increasing military budgets, having been dependent upon the claim of an international communist conspiracy and subversion, and the threat of a Soviet Union sponsoring revolutionary change, an empty threat as it happened, but nonetheless the basis and the rationale for the militarization of the American economy and the ever-increasing addiction to arms expenditure. $9 trillion in the space of four decades, more than the combined productive value of everything produced in this society, sustaining this military machine. False flag operations. In 1962, when the United States had set itself upon the course of destroying the Cuban Revolution, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Lyman Limnitzer, proposed a plan in the National Security Agency, which became known as Operation Northwoods. Now, this was not the wet dream of marginal figures. The chairman of the Joint Chief had this plan signed off on by all members of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And it called for the hijacking of airplanes and crashing them into prominent buildings in Washington, D.C. and in Miami. The assassination of civilians and raids upon civilian targets in those cities. It anticipated the blowing up of the rocket carrying the astronaut John Glenn. And it was to impute all of these actions to the Cuban Revolution to provide the basis for an instant invasion of Cuba. Our people being whipped into a numbed acquiescence, a hysterical response to the supposed attacks by the Cubans upon the United States. Meticulously documented in the book by James Bamford, Body of Secrets. James Bamford, the co-producer with Peter Jennings of ABC News Tonight. A model of the false flag operation that characterizes the workings of American imperialism. But indeed, we should look for a moment at the subsequent events, because as you're aware, this particular operation which went up to the Kennedy brothers was sent back for refinement. They thought the hand of U.S. intelligence would be too transparent, and they wanted some variations on the theme. It's not long after that that the Kennedy assassination proceeds in the United States. Now, the official fiction that was presented immediately in the aftermath of the execution of John F. Kennedy was that a lone nut assassin had carried out the event. But that lone nut was not only a nut, he was a Marxist and a Fidelista and a defector, we were told, to the Soviet Union. Indeed, the entire biography of this lone nut had been prepared so well in advance that L. Fletcher Prouty, who was an instructive figure, the colonel who was liaison in the Eisenhower administration between Defense Intelligence and the National Security Agency for assassination, nominally overseas assassination. L. Fletcher Prouty had been sent to New Zealand. He hadn't signed on for the execution of the head of state. And in his book, The Secret Team, Fletcher Prouty notes that the biography of Lee Harvey Oswald as the lone assassin had been published in the New Zealand press prior to the event. The dateline, it seems, having confused some in what passes for an intelligence agency in the United States. We established in Great Britain at the time, in early 1964, the Who Killed Kennedy Committee, with Bertrand Russell and Arnold Toynbee and Lord Boyd Orr and Hugh Trevor Roper and so on. And I mentioned that only to make clear to you that within a relatively short space of time, we had acquired a series of documents, some of them liberated from the offices of the district attorney in Dallas, which established, in fact, that the lone nut assassin had a Secret Service report, 767, containing his FBI number, S172, and a CIA number, 110669, with a crypto security clearance at Atsugi Air Force Base, where he was monitoring U-2 overflights of the Soviet Union. And Oswald, having long been established as an operative and sent on an assignment as a nominal defector to the Soviet Union, was not the only one who showed the hands of intelligence. Jack Ruby, his assassin, was an undercover FBI operative who actually had an assignment from the FBI when he organized the murder of Leon Cook, the secretary of the Scrap Iron and Junk Handlers Local of the Teamsters Union in Chicago in 1939, as reported in the Chicago Tribune on December 9th, the means through which the FBI directed the mob into its takeover and control of the Teamsters in the late 1930s after the cross-country industrial union organizing that Farrell Dobbs and the Teamsters had introduced into American labor, targeted immediately by the intelligence agencies and the rulers of this country. Jack Ruby, by the way, appeared at the hearings of the House Un-American Activities Committee in 1947, which then-Congressman Richard Nixon described his role in supplying the committee with information on subversives in the trade union movement, whereupon he was assigned by J. Edgar Hoover to Dallas, Texas, where his role included gun running into Cuba, even, by the way, with Frank Sturgis supplying the nascent July 26 movement and the CIA efforts to penetrate that activity and that organization and that struggle, leading, in fact, to the point where Frank Sturgis and Jack Ruby were put in charge of two gaming casinos in Havana with the advent of the Cuban Revolution, and Frank Sturgis put in charge of Air Force intelligence in Cuba. Not just a CIA operative, by the way, involved subsequently, as you know, in Watergate, but a principal figure in the Kennedy assassination itself. Their base of operations, E. Howard Hunt and Frank Sturgis, as it turns out, at 544 Camp Street in New Orleans, the nominal address of the one person, Fair Play for Cuba Committee of Lee Harvey Oswald. The beat goes on. With the Kennedy assassination followed that of his brother. We recall that the event was attributed to a Palestinian named Sirhan Sirhan, but the coroner's report of Thomas Noguchi showed that not a single bullet from the gun of Sirhan Sirhan struck Robert Kennedy, that he was killed by a shot at the base of the skull at point-blank range at the right occipital bone, and with two other bullets that struck him, all from the same assailant, His security guard, Eugene Thain Cesar, positioned directly behind him and assigned him not only by the Los Angeles Police Department, but by the intelligence agencies and the mob with which he had been long associated. False flag operations, the hallmark of American imperialism in action, and the power of a ruling class that is, in effect, a criminal conspiracy in this country. How often have you heard the charge that those who attempt to document the ongoing record of the murder state in the hands of American capitalism as conspiracy mongers? Well, it is true that history is not driven by conspiracy, but those who hold power act in conspiratorial ways because they dare not acknowledge to those they control and manipulate the ways in which they sustain their rule. And it is our responsibility to take note of the fact that every major investigative undertaking by nominal judicial authority in this country, municipal, county, state, federal, deploys the charge of conspiracy. Conspiracy to defraud is the most frequently invoked judicial operation of the authority. The only conspiracy that they're not interested in is the doings of those who control. And those who invoke this category as a way of cutting off the necessity to speak truth to power and to document its events are engaged in a form of intellectual cowardice and attaching the label to something to better to dismiss it without having to think about it. We start with the evidence. That's the crux of the matter. The false category of terror. In the late 1970s, the Mossad, the Israeli intelligence services, concocted a document called a strategy for the 1980s, in which they set forth the necessity, not just for Israel, but for the United States, to fragment each Middle Eastern country in its turn into its original religious and ethnic components, the better to seize the resources direct, and the necessity for a permanent military apparatus of war to obtain and to sustain these objectives. Maya will discuss later the article in the New York Times called The Sunshine Warrior, in which Paul Wolfowitz was heralded by Eric Shinseki, the chief of staff of the Army, for having contrived and arranged the preparations for the permanent war in the Middle East in the 1970s, of which the war in Iraq was but a beginning and an expression. Yes, the category of terror, the false category of terror, proceeds with a series of conferences in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, in which a particular figure was involved, namely Netanyahu, the subsequent Prime Minister of Israel, who, as Haier and Haaretz disclosed in subsequent articles and then the Washington Report on the Middle East by Nevi Gordon, was a Central Intelligence Agency figure working in the United States under three identities, John L. Sullivan, John L. Sullivan Jr., and the conferences on terror that he organized in Tel Aviv and Washington with George Bush and George Shultz and James Baker were to set the platform and the table for the American Enterprise Institute, the Project for the New American Century, the Jewish Institute for National Security Affairs, what are known as the neocons, the Center for Defense Preparation of Richard Perle, the entire apparatus that has been involved in the preparations for the seizure of resources in the Central Asian region and throughout the Middle East itself.
You've been listening to an excerpt, Ralph Schoenman, presenting the underlying politics of 9/11. Wow, I have to say. Even after 22 years, and having heard this before, I still have to say, wow. And I think you're probably saying that too. 212-209-2950. Our premium, our gift to you for your contribution, your generous contribution to WBAI of $100, the underlying politics of 9/11. Now, if you're listening on the Internet, you can make a secure donation to WBAI via the internet at www.wbai.org. And the underlying politics of 9/11 is premium number 104. That's 104. But if you're in the tri-state region, you can call 212-209-2950. We have wonderful volunteers in the pledge room ready to take your call. And if the lines get filled up and you get a busy signal, try again. The underlying politics of 9/11, a 2-CD, 2 hours and 40 minutes, very high fidelity, 212-209-2950. Now, it's only Ralph who can make a connection, in my book, between the Kennedy assassination and the events of 9/11. Now, you may have heard us talk about false flag operations. Ralph, you want to explain false flag operations? And, by the way, on this remarkable presentation of the underlying politics, Ralph goes into the details of the events of 9/11 and why it is a false flag operation. But first, let's explain what we mean by false flag operations.
Well, Maya, a false flag operation is actually an intelligence term when a heinous operation or crime is conducted in the name of people you want to target and you wish to offer up as a demonic presence to provide a justification for long-prepared plans. For example, the blowing up of the Maine is attributed to Spanish aggression. The sinking of the American ship at Tong Bay of Tonkin attributed to the Vietnamese. Always it is the people who are intended to be the target of American imperial plans were set up by a U.S. operation itself. Take, for example, in regard to 9/11, which we document in this presentation.
Well, before you do that, let's remind everyone, 212-209-2950. I want to hear the phones ringing a little louder and many more. Keep them coming consistently, because the longer they ring, the more I'm going to let Ralph speak. So 212-209-2950 and your secure contribution on the internet at www.wbai.org. Remember, MasterCharge, Visa, or bank debit card, checks, any way you can, 212-209-2950.
Well, Maya, really the heart of the matter is this. In the intervening two-plus years since the devastation of September 11th, 2001, the media in the United States have saturated our population with a series of fictions, of fictive descriptions of reality that correspond to a false flag operation. How often have we taken for granted now on the basis of reports that those planes were hijacked by Arab terrorists and crashed into the World Trade Center and into the Pentagon.
And in fact, much is being made now of the fact that the so-called terrorists were from Saudi Arabia, and as our Taking Aim listeners know, we did two specific programs on setting up the Saudis and taking out the Saudis to expose that disinformation.
Well, yes, and but you see, what we want to do here in examining the role of the established media is to emphasize the precious and critical importance of a vehicle, of a medium of information, of analysis, free speech radio, Pacifica Network, WBAI, Taking Aim, in order to present the actual record of events, to arm us with the information necessary to penetrate the cloud of disinformation and to expose and to respond to and to organize against the insidious plans that inform the gangster state.
212-209-2950, the underlying politics of 9/11. Now remember, this is our gift to you and for the maintenance, the sustenance of our radio station. That's yours and mine and all the people throughout the world who rely upon WBAI as a source of information and as a source of learning about places and ways in which we can organize for a better life for each and every one of us. Ralph.
The BBC, on the 23rd of September 2001, ran an important story. Hijacked suspects are alive and well. another of the men named by the FBI and the United States government as a hijacker in suicide attacks in Washington and New York has turned up alive and well. The identities of four of the 19 suspects accused of having carried out the attacks are in full doubt. Saudi Arabian pilot Walid al-Shehri, one of the five men that the FBI and the U.S. government state deliberately crashed American Airlines Flight 11 into the World Trade Center on the 11th of September, is indeed alive and well. He informed journalists that not only had he nothing to do with the attacks on New York and Washington, but he had been in Morocco when they happened. He has contacted both Saudi and American authorities to disavow the stories that have been published about him. Indeed, Abdulaziz al-Omani, another of the Flight 11 so-called terrorists who had been stated by the United States to have been one of the hijackers, is not only an engineer with Saudi telecoms, but had his passport stolen while studying in Denver, the BBC tells us. And Abdulaziz al-Omari was a pilot for Saudi American Airlines who had never flown in the United States. And indeed, al-Shakh al-Aswad newspaper, a London-based Arabic daily, stated that Saeed al-Ghamhi, another of those who was supposed to have been one of the hijackers aboard the planes that crashed into the World Trade Center, was interviewed by them after the event. He was listed by the FBI as the hijacker in the United Airlines flight that crashed in Pennsylvania. And the BBC story analyzes each of the accused hijackers and questions the authenticity of the public record put forward by the U.S. authorities.
Now, it's important to note that that was on September 23rd, 2001. How they forget. But we don't forget. And we compile this information and along with analysis because it's putting its information in context, understanding, making sense so that we don't feel confused and frightened about what is happening, but understand the reasons and what we can do about it. And that's why we rely upon WBAI to broadcast throughout the tri-state region, an important region in the world, and also over the internet. So much has been taking place at WBAI with the development of an incredible website that becomes a link to other websites and also links to each and every one of our own programmer websites. Ours is www.takingaim.info. This isn't possible without our sustenance of WBAI. 212-209-2950. The underlying politics of 9/11 for your generous contribution of $100. Now remember, if you can afford more than $100, this is the time. This is the time to say to yourself and to say to everyone, I support WBAI. This is my radio station, and I am going to make the underlying politics of 9/11 available to all my friends, my colleagues throughout the world, because this is a program you are going to want to hear over and over again. We're only playing segments. These are only segments. And you're going to want to have it all put together. 212-209-2950. This is your last opportunity during the fund drive, so don't say I'm going to put it off till later. Now is the moment. 212-209-2950. Rock, you've got more information
on some of the
supposed hijackers.
Let's look at how the false flag operation works. On June 20th, 2003, the New York Times and the press in general published widely the claim that there was a plot to destroy the Brooklyn Bridge and that a key al-Qaeda operative had been arrested in relation to the event. Prior to that, on the 22nd of May, a story was carried which stated al-Qaeda is getting ready for the next operation. On March 2nd, 2003, we were told that one of the September 11th masterminds was held. Who is this figure? Iman Faris, the al-Qaeda operator, unmasked last week of having planned to bring down the Brooklyn Bridge. But what did the Daily Telegraph in London discern and discover? That Iman Faris was an FBI operative, that indeed he had been involved with the Federal Bureau of Investigation working out of its offices, installed in a safe house in Virginia, sending messages to putative al-Qaeda figures by mobile phone and email, sitting, quote, as the Daily Telegraph describes it, in the safe house, making calls for us. It was a huge triumph, the Daily Telegraph cites a senior Bush administration official. But the media in the United States did not present it as a false flag operation and a triumph in setting up people and imputing to these people an operation to bring down the Brooklyn Bridge, not to mention other planned operations in the United States. No, we were not told that these, in fact, were intelligence operations of the United States government. Wherever you touch the events pertaining to 9/11, the hands of intelligence are all over them.
212-209-2950. I want to thank all of you who've been calling and remind those of you who still haven't picked up your phone, this is your last opportunity for the underlying politics of 9/11. You're going to regret not picking up the phone, so I advise you do it now. Call your friends, call your colleagues, and say to them, come on, let's go into this together, 212-209-2950, or on the internet at www.wbai.org. You can make a secure contribution with your credit card, and the underlying politics of 9/11 is 104 on the premium part of the website, 212-209-2950. We want to play a little bit more. This will be the last 10 or so minutes of Ralph's presentation. The underlying politics of 9/11 has three distinct sections. The first was a presentation by Ralph. The second is a presentation by me, and we're going to hear an excerpt, although it's a small excerpt, because during it I go into the economic basis for the permanent war and how the ruling class goes about it. And then we have a remarkable question and answer period, which tonight we're going to play a section of. So 212-209-2950. We're going to go now to the last segment. That means that if you don't call and you don't get the underlying politics of 9/11, you are missing out on the very extensive, detailed unfolding of how the staged event took place by Ralph Shulman. I mean, not that it took place by Ralph Shulman, but his presentation and analysis. The underlying politics of 9/11, your contribution of $100, 212-209-2950. Sean, can we roll up track 8?
False flag operations characterize almost every major foreign policy démarche of the ruling class and its instruments. Let's take a look for the moment at a particularly apposite example of the false flag operation that has been in the news rather recently. Many of you are aware that the United States government imposed upon Libya acceptance of responsibility for the downing of Pan Am 103, the flight that was brought down in Lockerbie, Scotland. And indeed, the Libyans, who had been subject not only to an armed attack by the United States that killed the adopted daughter of Muammar Gaddafi, but to sanctions which had shut Libya off from all trade and had prevented any airlines from flying out of Tripoli or Benghazi or flying in, had been virtually brought to its knees and accepted to acknowledge formal responsibility while stating that the people who were accused were entirely innocent. There's a particular aspect to the Pan Am 103 debacle. At the time of the attack on Pan Am 103 at Lockerbie, the insurance company for Pan American Airways was faced with multi-billion dollar lawsuits and hired an organization called Interforce, which is a collection of former Mossad operatives, German intelligence operatives, Central Intelligence Agency operatives, and DIA operatives who are now in business for themselves, having retired. And for COIN, Interforce conducted an investigation into the circumstances and the events of Pan Am 103. And what they determined and what they established and what they documented in that report was of great instruction. Pan Am 103 was a flight that was carrying 8 intelligence operatives who were coming in from the cold, from the drug smuggling operations that they were doing on behalf of the DEA and the DIA and the Central Intelligence Agency in the Middle East. Drugs that were being run from the Middle East into American cities, much as has been done out of the operations that were conducted from MENA, Arkansas, by people linked both to the Clinton and Bush administrations. And what this report established is that the plane was taken out by the Central Intelligence Agency, and it was intended to have been downed over the waters before reaching Scotland, so no evidence would be apparent. The entire report was then picked up by the Toronto Star in a series of articles by John Picton, and it was given to a congressman named James Traficant, the Democrat from Ohio, who is the only congressman, by the way, who not only read out the report in Congress, but called for an investigation, and was immediately then targeted for the charge of having been involved in bribery, swiftly removed from Congress, and currently in jail. But the Toronto Star described in a series of articles that were then picked up and elaborated upon in Barron's, the financial journal, not only with respect to Pan Am 103, but to a similar flight that was crashed in Gondar off Newfoundland within a similar MO, intelligence agencies coming out of an operation to disclose the flight downed in a classic false flag operation. And Victor Ostrovsky, in his important book, The Other Side of Deception, and Ari Ben-Menashe in his book, The Prophets of War, Victor Ostrovsky, I should mention, a colonel in the Mossad, described a series of paradigmatic false flag operations. Specifically, you will recall the hijacking of the Achille Lauro, a pleasure cruiser with tourists on it, when an American elderly Jewish man, Leon Klinghoffer, in a wheelchair, was brutally thrown overboard. This event attributed to the Palestine Liberation Organization and Abu Abbas and his organization in Damascus. What Ostrovsky documents is that this, in fact, was an operation of Rafi Eitan, a Mossad operation imputed to the Palestinians, every aspect of it controlled by the Mossad. Operation Trojan. Operation Trojan, as Ostrovsky documents, involved the following. The Israeli Mossad installed equipment in a building 2 doors, 3 buildings away from Muammar Gaddafi's headquarters. This equipment sent signals to embassies, and in these signals were plans to blow up the Berlin discotheque, La Belle discotheque, and to carry out assassinations on the part nominally of the Libyan authorities. French and Spanish intelligence identified these as Mossad-contrived signals. The German public television station documented that, in fact, the blowing up of the La Belle discotheque was the work of Mossad operatives. Their names specified a full and detailed report in the German publication Frontal. But the blowing up of the Berlin discotheque, La Belle discotheque, was the pretext and the basis for the attacks upon Tripoli, for ILSA, the Iran-Libya Sanctions Act of that congressman from the Mossad, Tom Lantos, that calls for the punitive sanctions not only against the Libyans, but against any company, European or other, that trades with the Libyans. These are the hallmark features of the gangster state. The particularity of the role of Mohammed Atta, of Zacharias Massawi, the role of the Mossad itself, as a four-part series in the Fox television news established, as ABC Frontline made clear, Mossad operatives from Odigo, the communications company, company who gave prior warning to their Israeli employees at the World Trade Center of the events of 9/11, to the white van and the urban moving company, which were a Mossad operation, photographing the attacks on the World Trade Center in position hours before, in position at the Sears building in Chicago, with similar maps and in preparation for the intended attack on the Sears Tower, the 200 Mossad operatives, 60 of them stationed in Hollywood, Florida, a group of them within houses of the residents of Mohammed Atta, in constant communication with him, Mohammed Atta residing with Charlie Voss, the former Contra pilot and the flyer of C-130s for Iran-Contra, working for Rudy Decker. Everywhere you touch this, and we've only begun to touch the surface of it, the hands of intelligence are all over the events of 9/11. What we have to do in understanding this is to ask the question, who gains and why? What is the function of an event like 9/11? Well, we know. Permanent war. A justification for a war that they tell us will not end in our lifetimes, with 60 countries targeted, with trillions of dollars now allocated to the military maw, with the virtual suspension of nominal constitutional protections in the United States, all of the apparatus of martial law in place, with the attempt to impute to any who challenge the American imperium the role of terrorists. But there is a real and abiding terrorism, and it is that of state terrorism, the state terrorism of our ruling class. And the events of 9/11 are but the little continuation of how it has conducted its affairs for the past 150 years. But there's an old saying in this country, the longer you con people, the madder they are when they find it out. When we find that the putative hijackers are staying with an FBI operative in San Diego, according again to the Washington Post. When we learn that the events attributed to hijackers involved in a terrorist operation are carried out by high-ranking FBI agents, as the San Francisco Chronicle established with respect to the blowing up of the American embassy in Nairobi. A high-level FBI operative conducted and organized that operation. The same man who had, by the way, organized the bodyguards for Osama bin Laden, San Francisco Chronicle. This is not a series of random events that we're describing, but a controlling and defining pattern of events that addresses us to the authors of the events of 9/11. I hope in the question and answer we can delve further into this, but I want to say to you this, that those who avoid addressing this reality, those who direct their attention to everything but, those who impugn the people who attempt to research, to investigate, to expose, and to describe the dynamics of 9/11, function as gatekeepers for the ruling order. They are an obstacle in the path. They do nothing to illuminate what has to be done. They do everything to protect the perpetrators of this crime. We have to call it by its name. We have to tell it like it is. And we have to mobilize and organize around this reality. Thanks.
You've been listening to The Underlying Politics of 9/11, a presentation by Ralph Schoenman, Maya Schoen, myself, and it took place about a month ago here in Vallejo to a packed house, and we've edited it, and it's now a gift to you for the WBAI Fall Fund Drive. $100, two CDs, incredibly audio, high fidelity, 2 hours and 40 minutes, The Underlying Politics of 9/11, 212-209-2950. You've only heard small segments from Ralph's incredible, and I'll say illuminating, as he did, presentation, where he synthesizes information, disparate information, information from many, many sources, meticulous documentation, and puts it all together to make the events such as 9/11 and the unfolding permanent war have some meaning so that we can organize against it. For instance, the Associated Press, Matt Kelly, Saturday, October 25th, wrote, "Pentagon repositioning for decades-long war on terror." Given the chance to talk to the Defense Secretary, one soldier from the 101st Airborne Division asked what was on the minds of many. "When will the worldwide fight against terrorism be over? I mean, should I get my three-year-old ready for air assault school?" the soldier asked Defense Secretary Donald H. Rumsfeld during an Iraq tour last month. And Rumsfeld responded, "I wish I could give you a date, but I can't." And the Chronicle, in the Chronicle, San Francisco Chronicle, Matt Kelly, the Associated Press writer, stated that the Cold War that dominated the second half of the 20th century, what we see now, the administration admitting that its anti-terrorism fight is going to be a decades-long struggle. And he refers to the memo that Rumsfeld had issued to his top aides and which was revealed to the press. Quote, "It's pretty clear that the coalition can win in Afghanistan and Iraq in one way or another, but it will be a long, hard slog." So they have prepared themselves for decades-long war, permanent war. And in the underlying politics of 9/11, we analyze why they have gone about creating this permanent war and how they do it. 212-209-2950. 212-209-2950. This is a program you're not going to want to be without. Those of you who are Taking Aim listeners who heard about tonight, we know that you'll be calling in. And those of you who haven't heard us before, this is
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. And our program, Taking Aim, is normally on Tuesdays from 5 to 6 p.m. Bernard White, the program director, thought that you would like to get a glimpse of Taking Aim and have an opportunity to hear the underlying politics of 9/11. We really appreciate the programmer, the education show that's on now, allowing us to have the time to be here with you. So 212-209-2950, this is your last opportunity. Remember, the WBAI is our station. Yours and mine, and it cannot exist without our contribution. We're unpaid programmers. There's an important staff at WBAI, the engineers, and everyone in the back room that keeps this station going, keeps the high fidelity, keeps the transmission. We rely on all of us volunteers, and those of you who are volunteering in the pledge room, I want to send my heartfelt thanks to you for answering the phones and talking to each and every person, subscriber, who's calling in. And those of you who are calling in, we want to mention just a few of you. We'll only have time for now. And keep those phones ringing. While the premium is on, we're going to play more in the second hour. And while we're talking, still 212-209-2950 is the number to call. And if you're out of the tri-state region, you can make a secure contribution on the Internet at www.wbai.org. Because these are the last moments of the fun drive, we're going to do quite a lot of pitching with that phone number, so you don't forget it, 212-209-2950. And when we return to our regular programming next week, as you know, it's facts and fact-intensive, and you can't be away from the radio for even a second. Meanwhile, we're giving you enough time to get to your phone and dial.
Yes, please keep those phones ringing. Please call in your contribution. Please obtain the premium, the underlying politics of 9/11, sustain Free Speech Radio, WBAI, support Taking Aim. Keep the beat on for information that you can't get in the established media.
Sean, do you have names of some of the people we can thank?
Yes, I do. We have John in Brooklyn. Thanks. We have Warren in Staten Island. Thanks to you. Stuart in White Plains, New York. Thanks. We have Amshad in Baskin Ridge. Thanks. We also have to give thanks to Doris Woods in Suffern. Brenda Alexander in Brooklyn. Juan Batista in the Bronx. Iris McDonald from Washington Township. John Miglietta, excuse me if I'm butchering that, also in New York. Leslie Trumbull from New York as well. Jonathan Feldman in New York. And Abdullah Nazir in Flushing.
Great. Thank you, all of you. As you can see, Taking Aim listeners are throughout the region. And we know that people are making their secure contributions on the Internet, www.wbai.org. We're always getting calls from people from all over the country and emails at our Taking Aim web email address, which is now on the WBAI website. That's takingaim@wbai.org. WBAI.org. But right now, we want you to go to the WBAI website and make your secure contribution. The underlying politics of 9/11 is premium number 104. But you can call 212-209-2950. Russ?
Well, Maya, the false flag operation, which is the theme of what we do in explaining the underlying dynamics of 9/11, affects every aspect of it. At every conjuncture where the rulers in this society contemplate a new military adventure, they trot out the demonic figures they have always deployed to mobilize support and to terrorize our people into acquiescence. In the past couple of months, we have had a drumbeat of such claims. On the 4th of September, the New York Times, Bin Laden pledges more attacks. On the anniversary of 9/11, George Bush cited in the Washington Post, citing the new terror attacks that are inevitable as the rationale for upping the ante and preparing military action against Syria and Iran. And indeed, the priority that was attributed to Bin Laden by Newsmax on September 15th, the use of biological weapons. The use of biological weapons...
Ralph, we're going to come back to that in a moment. It's the top of the hour. And right now, WBAI, as all the Pacifica stations, are engaged in the democratic process of elections for the board. And we have a short announcement about that. You're listening to Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoen
and Maya Schoen on WBAI 99.5 FM in New York and over the Internet at www.wbai.org. So Sean's going to play the information about the election, and then we're going to be back with you, and Ralph has some startling information.
This is Joy Williams, election supervisor for WBAI. If you listen to and care about WBAI, this is for you. The Pacifica Foundation, which holds the license for WBAI and four other stations across the country, has new bylaws. And if you have contributed at least $25 in the past year or volunteered at the station for 3 or more hours, then you are a WBAI member and can vote in the upcoming local station board election. Not a member yet? Visit our website at www.wbai.org or call our switchboard at 212-209-2800 to volunteer your time or to make a financial contribution today. Don't miss this opportunity to participate in the first ever WBAI local station board election. Become a member today. Again, visit our website at www.wbai.org or call 212-209-2800.
This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen, and we're coming tonight with our special premium show, The Underlying Politics of 9/11. Another number you can call to become a WBAI member is 212-209-2950. That's the pledge line. And our contribution for the WBAI Fall Fund Drive is a 2-CD, 2-hour, and 40-minute jam-packed program, The Underlying Politics of 9/11, high fidelity, fully tracked, and presentation by Ralph Schoenman, and then by myself, Maya Schoen, and questions and answers with Ralph Schoenman responding to significant questions from the audience. Again, 212-209-2950. If you're tuning in and expecting the normal program of this time on Thursday, I'd like to introduce us, this Ralph Schoenman, Maya Schoen. Our program Taking Aim is normally on Tuesday from 5 to 6, and we're glad to be with you and to meet you all. So please call 212-209-2950. In the first hour, we played excerpts from Ralph's presentation. This hour, we're going to play a little excerpt from my presentation and then also the questions and answers. But first, Ralph has found some important information and we wanted to share it with you.
Well, Maya, I was mentioning the attribution to Osama bin Laden of plans for biological warfare, which Bush was trumpeting on the anniversary of September 11th, in which the established media have been particularly adept at disseminating over the past six weeks. The drumbeat of a new biological warfare menace, no longer from Saddam Hussein, but now from, once again, none other than Osama bin Laden from his cave in Afghanistan. Here's a report in the Herald in the United Kingdom of today's date. Doomsday fears over new pox virus. Scientists have genetically modified a virus from the smallpox family to create a super lethal strain as part of an advanced research program of the United States government. Dr. Mark Butler of the University of St. Louis, who trained at Glasgow, told the New Scientist that the work was part of an advanced program for the weaponizing of this smallpox virus by the United States. Other researchers say the work has created enormous risks and that this is a weapon which undoubtedly may be used. The research suggests that pox viruses will be turned into deadly weapons, he warned. Vaccines, the main defense against smallpox and his relatives, such as the monkeypox, which caused an outbreak in the U.S. this year, will be overwhelmed by this modified virus strain, which is deployed as a weapon. Indeed, Dr. Rumsher was among scientists who discovered how to make mousepox more deadly for the U.S. authorities 3 years ago. And the article, which is an elaborate one, documents an ongoing, active program for weaponizing smallpox and for testing and for using it. And that, indeed, is the ongoing plan for biological warfare, a plan that has long been documented through such books as Clouds of Secrecy, which we've cited so often on Taking Aim. When you have these cover stories imputing to demonic others the plans that the U.S. authorities have themselves well advanced, you understand the meaning of false flag and the actual dynamics of 9/11 itself.
Now, in my presentation, I go into the structure of the military-industrial complex and the corporate oil interests and how they are linked together and why they need permanent war. A key document is Rebuilding America's Defenses, which was written by the Project for the New American Century, September 2000, for our current President Bush's campaign. And it was built upon another document that had been produced under the auspices of then Secretary of Defense Dick Cheney under the first Bush 41 administration, and then had been squelched and has now reemerged with the Vice President. Rebuilding America's Defenses. The principal author, Thomas Donnelly, is now Director of Strategic Communications at Lockheed. But before that, from 1996 to 99, he had been on the Armed Services Committee of the U.S. House of Representatives, and this is the principal author. But the co-chairs of this project for the New American Century, Rebuilding America's Defenses, were Donald Kagan, who's the father of Robert Kagan, a founder of PNAC with William Crystal, and Gary Schmidt. And it's important to look at the participants. The participants include a who's who of the neocons of this administration. I. Lewis Libby, Vice President Dick Cheney's Chief of Staff. Robert Martinez, who is in the Defense Planning and Investment. Adam Schulsky, another name that you hear often because he writes with Zalmay Khalilzad. Zalmay Khalilzad, who became the pro-counsel in Afghanistan. Barry Watts, retired from the Air Force, is now with the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments and had headed the Office of Program Analysis in the Department of Defense. Dov Zakim is the Undersecretary of Defense, but actually he is the controller who handles the military budget. And Stephen Cambone, who was appointed by now President Bush as Undersecretary of Defense for Intelligence. It goes on and on and on, along with people such as the author who were very much involved in Lockheed Martin and the other military-industrial complex, Rebuilding America's Defenses. A key sentence ties this to 9/11 from this document, because under Vice President Dick Cheney, when he was Secretary of Defense, and now the current military-industrial complex, they have a shopping list of $4 trillion. Yes, I didn't make a mistake. It's $4 trillion. And you can see why they needed 9/11. They state clearly in Rebuilding America's Defenses, the process of transformation to have this huge military-industrial complex, quote, will be a long one, absent some catastrophic and catalyzing event like a new Pearl Harbor, end quote. That's why we prepared the underlying politics of 9/11, 212-209-2950. Get the phones ringing, and we'll continue playing excerpts from this important program. 212-209-2950. For your contribution of $100. Ralph?
How often have we been told that Osama bin Laden is preparing videotapes for our delectation on his plans, always announcing them, of course, to the convenience of our rulers well in advance? And indeed, in the most recent weeks, yet another videotape was presented, putatively that of Osama bin Laden, except for the fact that his voice is not on the tape, it is a voice of another. And that harks back to the initial videotape where Osama bin Laden was supposed to be taking responsibility for the events of 9/11, which were analyzed by audio experts in London and exposed as a scissors and paste job, in which a gathering at the wedding ceremony 2 years prior of associates of bin Laden was videoed, and bin Laden was praising the guests and the bride and groom at that ceremony. That was scissors and pasted into a video, imputing these sentiments to Osama bin Laden with respect to 9/11. A scissors and paste job exposed. And yet another tape at the time that the United States was saturation bombing in Afghanistan, once again attempting to provide a rationale by imputing to Osama bin Laden responsibility for the events of 9/11, a tape which was supposedly made with a paraplegic sheikh who was visiting him during the full moon of Ramadan, as the Central Intelligence Agency described it. Unfortunately for them, the full moon did not occur during Ramadan, and the time when this tape was supposed to have been made was one when there was saturation bombing in the area concerned, and not even Marines could get through with the firestorm that was detonating throughout the area. And yet, again, the tape ascribed to Osama bin Laden, this demonic figure, supposedly from a cave in Afghanistan with a couple of hundred of Central Intelligence Agency-financed operatives, more powerful than the Soviet Union, more dangerous than 50,000 H-bombs. It is Osama bin Laden from his cave in Afghanistan, the ultimate conspiracy theory.
212-209-2950 for the underlying politics of 9/11. Your $100 contribution to WBAI, your station that makes all of this possible, taking AIM and the other programs throughout the day, 24/7. 212-209-2950. Ralph, you know, you're talking about Osama bin Laden and the rationale originally for the invasion, the attack against Afghanistan. And at that very moment, it was the United States military were saying, quote, "It's very clear Afghanistan is a small piece of the war." That was a headline. And on ABC this week, Air Force General Richard Myers, who's the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, was interviewed, and he said, quote, that he had started to prepare targets in Iraq already. This was as they were preparing to invade Afghanistan. Again, global war and permanent war. As General Myers said explicitly, "We are thinking very broadly. Since World War II, we haven't thought this broadly about a campaign." And that's why we consider the preparation of a program like the underlying politics of 9/11 was critical at this moment. 212-209-2950. With a current $87 billion vote by Congress awarding the military-industrial complex so much more, and this is following on a prior $80 billion contribution, we are talking about it putting the American people in debt forever. In debt. Right now, the military industrial budget is 53% of the discretionary federal budget, and there are implications of that that are discussed in the on this program, the underlying politics of 9/11.
But Maya, indeed, the information that we seek to present, the documented reality, as opposed to the fiction that is perpetually disseminated in the established media, is the sine qua non of an informed and motivated and mobilized political resistance to the established order in the society. The BBC, on the anniversary of 9/11, the first anniversary, September 11th, published an actual interview with Osama bin Laden, not a faked tape, not a spliced tape, not a fake voice, but an actual interview. Quote, "I have already said I am not involved in the September 11th attacks in the United States. I had no knowledge of these attacks, nor do I consider the killing of innocent women, children, and other human beings an appreciable act. There exists a government within the government in the United States, and that second government must be asked as to who carried out these attacks. The United States should trace the perpetrators of these attacks to those persons want to make this present century a century of permanent conflict so their own rulers can survive." The BBC quoting the actual Osama bin Laden.
Well, Ralph, now let's go to another piece of the underlying politics of 9/11. 212-209-2950. Your contribution to WBAI of $100. We're coming into the middle of the presentation that I gave on the economic and social underpinnings of the events of 9/11 and the consequences for people in the United States. Sean?
Let's look below the surface. Why did this take place? And we came across a very interesting article that's dated from 1999. 1999 by Carl Limbacher and Karen Gritch, June 9, 1999. Quote, and they're quoting from the New York Times of September 21st, 1997, a good 4 years before the events of 9/11. Quote, "Forget mutual funds, commodity futures, and corporate mergers. Forget South African diamonds, European currencies, and Thai stocks. The most concentrated mass of untapped wealth known to exist anywhere is in the oil and gas fields beneath the Caspian Sea and the lands around it. The strategic implications of this bonanza hypnotize Western security planners as completely as the finances transfix oil executives." End quote. New York Times, September 21st, 1997. The Caspian Sea Basin is 4 million square kilometers and 70 million people live there in former republics of what had been the Soviet Union. As Ariel Cohn, the senior policy analyst of the Heritage Foundation, stated a year earlier, January 25, 1996, quote, "The vast expanses of the former Soviet Union harbor oil and gas riches, which will be crucial to funding the global economy in the next century. The huge oil reserves, estimated at over 25 billion barrels under the Caspian Sea and in the Central Asian republics of Kazakhstan, Turkmenistan, and Uzbekistan, are similar to those in Kuwait and larger than those in Alaska's North Slope and the North Sea combined." He continues, "Control over these energy resources and the export routes out of the Eurasian hinterland is quickly becoming one of the central issues in post-Cold War policies." Now, the key to this statement is the export routes, because while the oil is in the Central Asian republics and the country-selling leaders of these republics are all too willing to form relationships with the imperial oil corporations, the issue was how to get the oil to market. And the primary routes were through Afghanistan or through Iran. If you go to the Oil and Gas Journal, they stated explicitly, "By 2050, Central Asia should account for more than 80% of U.S. oil." Now, this is the U.S. Oil and Gas Journal writing about what they anticipate to drive the capitalist economy in the United States to feed its hunger for oil. They were going to depend upon Central Asia. They state, "Central Asia represents the world's last great frontier, offering opportunities for investment, production, transportation, and the refining of trillions of dollars of oil and gas services." The last great frontier. This was well known to Congress. It seems to be well known to the capitalist sponsors and well known to the Republicans and Democrats in Congress. The issue was what they were going to do about it to not only have the relationships with the Central Asian republics, which first of all meant the breakup of the Soviet Union, and then how they were going to get this oil once they built their exploration and their pumping stations, how they were going to get the oil to market. Where were they going to move their pipelines? The Subcommittee on Asia and the Pacific heard testimony from John J. Maresca, who was the Vice President of International Relations of UNICAL, on February 12, 1998. And he was explicit. He told them how to get the oil to market. He said, "The five countries that make up Central Asia, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Turkmenistan, Tajikistan, and Uzbekistan, have captured worldwide attention because of their phenomenal reserves of oil and natural gas." And last November, Secretary of Energy Frederico Peña led a presidential mission to the Caspian Central Asian region, and the fate of the area's energy resources were discussed. He said that there was a consortium of 11 foreign oil companies, including UNICAL, which he represented, Amoco, Exxon, and Pennzoil. To any who are familiar with the San Remo agreements of April 24, 1920, when the European powers and the United States carved up the Middle East and decided on the percentages of oil they would own and exploit respectively. If you think about that, what Maresca said falls into place, because he said to the subcommittee, quote, we are revisiting this agenda for Central Asia. We contemplate a pipeline south from Central Asia to the Indian Ocean. The only possible route is across Afghanistan, which presents its own unique challenges because the country is involved in bitter warfare and divided by civil war. He says, we have made it clear that construction of this pipeline will not begin until a recognized government has been put in place, and by this he means a government subordinate to the United States, one such as we have now with a proconsul, that has the confidence of governments, lenders, and our company. These capitalists, there is no illusion. They come right out and say what they mean. As you know, Mr. Chairman, we are working very closely with the University of Nebraska in developing a training program in Afghanistan, which will operate in both parts of the country, the north and the south. In other words, they will not only train the oil engineers, they will also train those who will rule, with quotes, Afghanistan. The problem was controlling Afghanistan. And then we see the events of 9/11 in a full context. Because what has happened since the events of 9/11? What has happened is that Zalmay Khalilzad, an Afghan emigre who was later selected by President Bush for the National Security Council, and as this was considered a specialist in Central Asian affairs, Zalmay Khalilzad was an ex-UNICAL man, and he became the U.S. envoy to Afghanistan after the U.S. bombing and seizure of the government. In effect, he was the U.S. proconsul in Kabul in the same way that L. Paul Bremer is the proconsul now in Iraq. He supervised the political affairs of the Afghan puppet regime from day to day. And the interim president, now the president of Afghanistan, Hamid Karzai, he had been a paid consultant for the U.S. oil industry. Afghanistan. Today, by the way, since the U.S. does not have full control in Afghanistan and is still engaged in a day-to-day direct war, the oil companies have begun construction of the Baku-Sehan oil pipeline involving the presidents of Azerbaijan, Georgia, and Turkey. And this will take the oil from Central Asia to the Turkish Mediterranean port of Ceyhan. But it can only take a small portion of the oil. And as a consequence, they are going to persist and persist and persist until UNICAL and its consortium will build their pipeline through Afghanistan. Because that is a pipeline that Enron had been involved in also, because it needed the natural gas that was going to go through the pipeline to fuel its projects in India. You have to look at the entire sweep of what it means throughout Asia, throughout Central Asia, and what this means to the United States. That's Afghanistan.
Yes. That's Afghanistan, and the next section looks at why Iraq. All of this has been part of grand designs. Grand designs, and that's why we prepare the underlying politics of 9/11. Our gift to you for your contribution, your generous contribution to WBAI of $100. Now, $100 is not the limit. You can go above. But for $100, you will get the underlying politics of 9/11, be a member of WBAI, or renew your membership. There are other ways to contribute, so please call 212-209-2950 to learn to speak, to to get to speak to the wonderful volunteers in the pledge room, and they will tell you about all the other options. 212-209-2950. And if you looked in the newspaper today, you will see that Afghanistan, according to the so-called experts, might become a country, a narco-controlled country. The opium, the heroin required, the opium produced in Afghanistan has now increased by 7% under the U.S.-controlled government in Afghanistan, and the country itself is controlled by what are called narco warlords. 212-209-2950. Ralph?
Translate the instruments of the Central Intelligence Agency that have marketed heroin into the United States from Afghanistan, from Southeast Asia, and throughout the Middle East. But in this documentation and programming, in the premium that we're presenting, you will learn how Mohammed Atta was trained at International Officers School at Maxwell Air Force Base in Montgomery, Alabama. How Abdulaziz Al-Amari was trained at Aerospace Medical School at Brooks Air Force Base in Texas. How Saeed Al-Adham Hamdi was at the Defense Language Institute in Monterey, California. How Mohammed Atta spoke to his father in Cairo on September 12th, as Newsweek acknowledged, the day after he was supposedly crashing an airliner into the World Trade Center. And you will hear the second interview that Osama bin Laden gave in detail to the Pakistani publication Umat, in which he says, I have already stated, I am not involved in the September 11th attacks in the United States. As a Muslim, I try my best to avoid telling lies. I had no knowledge of these attacks. Islam strictly forbids causing harm to innocent women, children, and other people. The practice is forbidden even in the course of battle. And Osama bin Laden states in this interview, there are intelligence agencies in the United States. They require billions of dollars of funds from the Congress and the government every year. The funding issue is not a huge problem until the existence of the former Soviet Union ceased to be. But after that, these budgets were in danger. They need an enemy. They started their propaganda against Osama and the Taliban when they staged this event. And he continues, I must say, my duty is to awaken people to this reality. We are not hostile to the United States. We are against the system which makes other nations slaves and forces them to mortgage their political and economic freedom. This man has an analysis, and he has denied the events imputed to him without motivation if he is seeking to take credit for them. He is the paradigm of the false flag operation that an intelligence agency operates that the United States rulers have devised to deflect their own acts upon demonic others and to provide the rationale for all that has been described in this show, in this program, to this moment. Get the data, get the documentation, equip yourself with the analysis, prepare yourself for the political struggles ahead, support the station, support Free Speech Radio, sustain the programming of Taking Aim, call in your pledge, offer your support.
212-209-2950, and on the internet, for those of you listening throughout the world, at www.wbai.org. There's a secure way to make your contribution now at 104 is the Taking Aim Premium, the underlying politics of 9/11. That's 212-209-2950. Also, Ralph, in the staging of the grand chessboard, as Zbigniew Brzezinski calls the necessity for control of Central Asia. Now, as we speak, they're in the former Soviet states of Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, and Kyrgyzstan. The United States has built permanent military bases. And if you look at, again, rebuilding America's defenses, you find that there is this analysis of these forward bases throughout the world, in Central Asia, in Asia itself, in Southeast Asia, in the Middle East, and building new bases and having forward advanced equipment to secure the profits of Central Asia of $5 trillion of oil, the prophets of the Middle East, no longer having surrogates in the countries of the Middle East, but actually seizing direct control, country after country. And the BBC had noted October 11th, 2002, U.S. hawks target entire Middle East. That was the report of Tom Carver, the BBC Washington correspondent. And he said, beyond the talk of Saddam Hussein, there's another factor in White House war plans and ideology. The president's most senior advisors believe that the overthrow of Saddam Hussein is the first stage in a vision of the Middle East, end quote. But he went on to say that Syria, Saudi Arabia, and Egypt are next. The intellectual underpinnings are from Paul Wolfowitz, now the Deputy Secretary of Defense. And the BBC concluded that America will use its military power all over the world. Now this, as Ralph says, is deja vu all over again, because he referred in The Hidden History of Zionism, an important work by Ralph, to a detailed plan by the Mossad that had been prepared in 1979 and was published in the World Zionist Organization's newspaper, Kibbutzim Directions, in 1982. And that was prepared by Odin Enoch, and it's called for the fragmentation of each Middle Eastern country in turn into its ethnic and religious components, much what we see unfolding today. And it stated specifically, quote, Iraq is first. Rich in oil and internally torn, it is guaranteed as the initial target. Its dissolution is even more important than that of Syria, which, as we can see now, is on the radar screen, as well as Saudi Arabia. And that is why we're asking you to call and arm yourself with this important information and analysis so that it becomes yours, the underlying politics of 9/11, 212-209-2950. Before I turn it over to Ralph, let's get thank a few of the people who've called in already.
And there are quite a number. First off, we'd like to give thanks to Jerry and Elizabeth, Sherry in Nyack, Diane in Ozone Park, Clive in Hackensack, looks like Melinda in Brooklyn, Ivan in New Rochelle, Andrew in Walden, Joan in Cambria Heights, B from the Bronx, Stanley from New York, New York, Jeff from Morganville, Joyce from New York. Also, thanks go out to Clifton Durham, and he's from Brooklyn. We've got Parif from New Jersey, North Helden, it looks like, Helden. We've got Mark from Newton, New Jersey, Thomas from East Orange, John Lyon from New York, New York, Pierre Anton from Newark, Henry Anderson from Brooklyn. We've got Richard from Reading and Helen from Locust Valley.
Thanks to all of you. And those of you, now you can be inspired to dial 212-209-2950. This is your last opportunity. We have about 22 minutes left. 212-209-2950, the underlying politics of 9/11. We've only played small segments. Remember, it's your contributions. It's all of us. We're all in this together to keep programs such as Taking Aim on the air. Ralph?
Well, Maya, we've described the basic dynamic of deceit, what Ostrovsky in his book had called the other side of deception. You recall that the Israelis and the United States had targeted Libya, and they had imputed to the Libyan authorities responsibility for the destruction of the Pan Am 103 aircraft, only to have it exposed and documented, as we have cited so often on the air and in my book, Iraq and Kuwait, A History Suppressed, the role of the Central Intelligence Agency itself in the destruction of that plane. Here is a report in the Washington Report on the Middle East on the 25th of August of this year. The Libyan hit squad hoax. Soon after President Ronald Reagan took office in 1981, breathless articles about Libyan hit assassination squads occupied the front pages of the Washington Post. For 3 weeks, Washington Post readers and readers across the United States were obsessed with squads which reportedly originated in the Middle East, had reached Europe, and were currently in Canada, where they were poised to cross into the United States, quote, like a swarm of northern killer bees. How a group of assassins could be so easily tracked made the hit squad story somewhat ridiculous on its face, the Washington Report continues. However, immediately, heavy concrete barriers surrounded the White House, Capitol Hill, and the Department of State to much fanfare and the attention of television and the media, where they remain today. The hoax began to collapse when the Post assigned names to police-style composite drawings of the assassins, but Arabic language specialists recognized these names as Shia names, the religious group that disliked Gaddafi, and with no inducement to be his operative. Suddenly, the hit squads disappeared from the Washington Post, never to return. 5 years later, a two-line item in the Washington Post revealed the truth. The item appeared in a story about the Iran-Contra scandal, the worst foreign policy scandal in the U.S. history, Washington Report continues. Manuha Gorbanafar, an Iranian exile working in Washington for the Mossad, the Israeli Secret Intelligence Services, and the Central Intelligence Agency, confessed that he had invented the hit squads, quote, to hurt Libya, an enemy of Israel, and to prepare for pending attacks on Libya, unquote, the Washington Post, the Washington Report on Middle Eastern Affairs, the false flag operation, the signature of the gangster state, the state that terrorizes our own people and the peoples of the world with pretexts for long-standing plans for plunder, for pillage, for conquest, for occupation, and for permanent war. It is this information that we seek to document, to establish, to reveal, to expose. And we ask your support. We ask you to pledge. We ask you to call your support in for our premium, for Taking Aim, for WBAI, for Free Speech Radio, for the Pacifica Network.
212-209-2950. And what does it mean when we say 53% of the discretionary federal budget is going to the military-industrial complex? Right now, as we speak, there are 130,000 U.S. young men and women over in Iraq, occupying an occupying force, 130,000 of them. But did you know that it costs $250,000 a year to maintain each of those soldiers? That was how much it cost, according to the Congressional Budget Office, for the so-called peacekeepers in Bosnia, in the Balkans. Now, I calculated. Now, that is $32 billion this year. $32 billion just for the occupying army. Lockheed Martin was awarded $17 billion in defense contracts in the budget year that ended September 30th, according to a Pentagon announcement. And Boeing was second at $16.6 billion, up from $13.3 billion. Trillions of dollars are lost also, according to the Congressional Budget Office and CBS. These are money that goes to offshore bank accounts for the military-industrial complex. Now, when I'm not broadcasting Taking Aim, I work with unions and nonprofit organizations that are concerned with health care for very low-income seniors, seniors with income of less than $900 per month, and who need home care, who need assistance. We are forever, forever now facing massive budgetary cuts here in California, as you are in New York, and yet $250,000 per year for each occupying soldier in Iraq, and also the occupying soldiers in Afghanistan. In order to secure profits for the oil companies, as John Maresca had calculated, of $5 trillion. Now we ask you, isn't this the moment to dial 212-209-2950? Let's examine our priorities. and our priorities is a communication source for ourselves. We depend on WBAI, and WBAI is our station. It will not exist without each and every one of us. 212-209-2950. Now, last moment for Ralph, and then we're going to go to Ralph's response to some of the many questions.
Well, let me just cite the example of the Philippines, because it's a continuing war that the United States is waging, and the attention to that war has been less than it ought to be, because the decimation that's being unleashed by the Central Intelligence Agency and by the United States military in the Philippines is terrible indeed. There's mass hunger in the Philippines. There's mass resistance to the basically puppet regime in power in Manila. Here on the 27th of July, 2003, was reported in Agence France-Presse. A group of Philippine soldiers rigged a giant Manila shopping mall with C4 explosives, and the soldiers' accusations, which were then released exposing the event, were explosive in the Philippines. Namely, that the Filipino government and the Central Intelligence Agency was behind the recent so-called terrorist actions, the bombing of the airport in Davao, the selling of weapons ammunition to figures who carried out so-called terrorist operations. We discussed this and the implications with Louis Franchia, the Agence France-Presse reporter, continues, and they document that the events in the Philippines for which the massive military budget delivering weapons to the government of the Philippines, carrying out suppressive operations throughout the country, has been justified. The putative terror events were the actions of special forces of the Filipino army under the direction of the CIA. That is the reality we seek to describe. Document. That is the information that Taking AIM will present to you, will make available to you, that we seek your support to continue on Taking AIM, WBAI, and Pacifica.
212-209-2950. The underlying politics of 9/11 will strip the veil from the eyes of your friends, your family, who, when you talk to them, are saying, how could you be saying such things? How could you say that a sector of the ruling class is responsible for 9/11, that our government is creating a false sense of terror and is stripping away our hard-earned funds, that the people in Congress, Democrats, Republicans alike, are supporting this, are complicit in this rape and pillage of each and every one of us? 212-209-2950. We'll be back with you in momentarily, but we want to play a few of the excerpts from the question and answer period of this startling presentation, The Underlying Politics of 9/11. Remember, go to your phones. This is your last opportunity. 212-209-2950. Sean, you want to go ahead with the beginning of the question and answers?
Go ahead.
Ralph, you know, I wouldn't raise this question if I wasn't concerned about it, but there seemed to be a lot of attention focused on the PNAC, you know, the Project of the New American Century, mm-hmm. and so forth, and you had talked about, you sort of flesh out the information about the Pearl Harbor scenario and so forth. But my concern is with especially the upcoming election coming up, where George Soros and all the big money people from the Democratic Party is bashing Bush for the war in Iraq. First, you know, whereas they say he should put his effort into the war on terror, which is exactly fits into what Maya talked about. You know, you're aware that Brzezinski wrote the book, The Grand Chessboard,
mm-hmm.
and he actually, in the book, he mentioned about the Pearl Harbor scenario. And to me, Brzezinski and Kissinger represents the democratic, the neoliberal wing of the New World Order, and which I'm, my concern is that a lot of people in the progressive sector is going to lend their support to the Democratic Party because they think that they're better than Bush. Can you a little bit
yes,
on that?
Yes, of course. Well, sure, this is a long-standing issue and problem. As you recall, every time that there is a national election, which is for nominal office, people are being whipsawed into being told, well, we have to support Truman over Dewey, or we have to support Johnson over Goldwater, or Walter Mondale over Ronald Reagan and so on, the evil lesser. But in fact, when you examine the structure of these parties, as Shu is indicating, for example, the National Security Advisors, the permanent bureaucracy of the intelligence agencies, the National Security Agency structure itself, the role of Wall Street, services both parties in the same fashion. They're funded by the same instruments, the so-called Team 100. The largest contributor to both parties is Lowry Cook of ARCO. Jackson Stevens, the figure of the National Security Agency based in Little Rock and in Venice, Florida, who is the linchpin to the series of intelligence-run schools that train the putative hijackers, who is linked to the BCCI, funding both Bush, funding both Clinton, both the Democratic Party and the Republican Party. This is the structure of a corporate ruling class and its enforcement apparatus. And as to the people who are taking their distance from the particular nature of the operation in Iraq, yeah, there are divisions which are essentially tactical divisions as to whether you need to retain what we call the comprador country-selling regimes, the pass-through. The present agenda is to demonize not just the Iraqis, but they're setting up the Saudis, too. All of that media campaign and in the 27 pages of the putative report that's fingering the Saudis as if this corrupt royal feudal elite will pass wind without direction from the Central Intelligence Agency, to which they are integrally linked, no less than Osama bin Laden and his Al-Qaeda apparatus. We'll elaborate upon that more. Let's go to the next question.
What can I do as an individual citizen in this country to stop this? Are human rights being taken away? We're invading other foreign countries. What can we do?
It's a question that goes to the heart of what we all confront each generation. The longer you wait, the longer it takes. We need to build, as Maya was indicating, a political instrument based upon the working population of this country, based upon the trade union movement, a movement for fundamental change that challenges the capitalist state, that poses the necessity for workers to control their own production for social need, as opposed to a system based upon the profit of the few. It's an ever-degenerating system, because this crisis that we confront of permanent war, of a Bonapartist state, of the projection of ever-increasing terrorist threats that are in fact state-sponsored, is a reflection of the decomposition of capitalism itself, which can no longer, even in the most remote sense, meet the elementary needs of working people, of the mass of humankind. Consequently, the immediate answer to that question is we have to organize a political instrument with breaks with the parties of capital, a party based on working people, a labor party, a working party, a party of the working and community population that challenges capitalism as a system, systemically, institutionally, across the board, and doesn't forever find itself co-opted by and ill-used by one of the soft cop, hard cop instruments of this tiny cabal, which is our criminal ruling class.
Hi, Ralph. I'm Phil from Sebastopol.
Yes.
And it appears to me that that the Bush administration and the neocons are deliberately taking from the poor and giving to the rich, and also deliberately trying to destroy our economy by plundering our treasury. Now, if this is true, what advantage would that be for these people?
Let me address that question by reference to an article in Insight on the News, which appeared on August 10th, 2001, quote, "Every year, trillions of dollars go unaccounted for by federal agencies. Robert Lieberman, the Deputy Inspector General of the Department of Defense, acknowledged that $4.4 trillion in the Pentagon's books had been cooked. In fact, in one year, $1.1 trillion was simply lost. No one knows where and to whom the money went." And the article continues, "Untold trillions of dollars are stolen every year, disappear into offshore numbered accounts, holding companies and banks without records." Now, interestingly, this article spells out that in the year 2000, the Pentagon lost over $855 billion, more than the total taxes collected by the IRS in 1999. On September 10th, 2001, The day before the attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, CBS News and its anchor Dan Rather reported the Pentagon has, quote, lost $2.3 trillion, fully one quarter of its budget for the decade, unquote, lost. As Helen Caldicott calculated, this is the anti-nuclear activist from Australia, $1 trillion represents $1,000 every minute since the life of Jesus. The capitalist system is cannibalizing the infrastructure of this society. These funds, which are offshore, numbered accounts, engaged in vast financial speculation, service the drug traffic, the covert operations, the very things that they need to sustain capitalist rule. But the answer to the question is that the system is no longer capable of functioning in any answerable fashion. It's an economy in terminal decline and in terminal decay. And what the rulers are doing is arrogating to themselves every last sou and deploying it primarily at our expense, off our necks, to sustain the national security state, the coercive arm, the enforcement apparatus of the rulers. Yes, Maya.
Okay. I neglected to mention that
Sean?
$87 billion, the amount that's allocated this year, or the $80 billion last year, is equivalent to the amount...
You've been listening to The Underlying Politics of 9/11. Our gift to you for your contribution to WBAI of $100. 212-209-2950. Hello? Oh, I lost him. Hello?
Well, I'm still here.
Sean?
I'm here.
Oh, did we lose you?
No, I'm here.
Okay.
Keep going.
Hi. For your contribution, 212-209-2950. In the last moments, we really want you to call. I'll say it again and again, 212-209-2950. It's your opportunity for the underlying politics of 9/11. We want to thank all of you, those of you who have been listening to us for the first time. You can hear us each week on Tuesday from 5 to 6 p.m. East Coast time and adjust it according to your time zone at www.wbai. And in the, as you know, it's 99.5 FM in the tri-state region of New York.
Maya, on the 11th of September 2002, a report by Gordon Thomas, Israel has mobilized 15,000 sleeper agents known as Sayanim across America. For the past month, in the utmost secrecy, they have been briefed by Mossad Operations Director Rafael Eitan on how to penetrate systems throughout the United States.
Yes,
and indeed, Maya, on July 11th, United Press International intelligence correspondent Richard Sale reports that Rafi Eitan, the Israeli spymaster, has, quote, reemerged on American soil and is being scrutinized as he prepares activity approved by the United States authorities. On August 7th, Sale wrote, U.S. officials have said that Eitan is back in operation for plans that both governments have approved.
Well, Rafi Eitan is... Oh, I'm sorry to interrupt you.
No, that's all right.
Rafi Eitan is the key figure in the funding operation for the Achille Lauro, one of the seminal false flag operations. Now, again, this is the last moments. 212-209-2950. The underlying politics of 9/11 is a program. It's something you're going to want to have in your library. You're going to want to share it with everyone you know. You're going to want to listen to it over and over again. I can tell you from my own experience of listening to it, we learn something new. Even though we're the ones who present it, each time we absorb more of the analysis.
Because now, the UPI story states the real story behind the heightened terror alert in the United States, unquote, and then elaborates. It is this synthesizing of events and organizing of data and analyzing of their meaning and arming of our constituency that we seek to accomplish on Taking Aim that our premium presents, that for which we ask your support.
Now, we have a website, www.takingaim.info, and thanks to Mark Bilk and Pamela Summers, We have been able to put up an archive that's there for you to download or to listen to, and it's free. Now, we can only produce the shows on that archive with intense information because of WBAI. And our heartfelt thanks goes out to all of you who contact us, all of you who listen and support the station.
And to our courageous collaborators and friends throughout the New York area, people like Father Lucas, people like Alambe Brass, people who are brothers and sisters in struggle. They are part of this effort. Support us all. Support the station. Support Taking Aim. Call your premium in, please.
212-209-2950, and also on the internet now for secure contribution at www.wbai.org. Again, this is the underlying politics of 9/11. You're not going to want to be without the underlying politics of 9/11. Thank you all. Sean?
Okay. Well, thank you, Ralph and Maya.